Good morning, Dr. Silberman. How's the knee?
The real question is, what are those?
Did you just have a brain fart?
I know Taekwondo.
Stop eating my sesame cake!
You're killing me, Smalls.
Fuck with me, and we'll see who shits on the sidewalk.
Come quietly, or there will be trouble.
Clearly, I wasn't talking to you, big titties. You cherub-looking motherfucker.
People keep asking if I'm back, and I haven't really had an answer. But now, yeah, I'm thinking I'm back.
Forever. 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 Forever.
I wanted to talk about Game of Thrones.
Okay.
And I wanted to talk about it for a specific reason. There are three hosts of this show, and only one of us has seen each and every episode and each and every season of Game of Thrones.
Which one is saying it's not like the other?
Like the other, right. And I think we know who has seen the show and who hasn't seen the show. Dwight has seen the show. He's a fan of the show. He's a fan of, you know, the whole universe.
Yeah. Dracarys.
Yes. Yes. Adrian and I have not seen an episode. And I've seen bits and pieces. Like, you know, just, I probably have seen collectively 40 minutes of Game of Thrones.
Wow.
But the reason I wanted to talk about it is because the show ended with its eighth season.
Yeah.
And I guess it started in what, 2011, and went almost 10 years, 2000 to 2019.
Wow. Yeah. It went for that long. Wow.
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. That's why I'm surprised. Yeah. I'm surprised you guys didn't see it in that time. That's just in mind, but yeah. It blows my mind.
Well, you know, I don't fuck with no fantasy shit, so I mean, that's just.
Dang, yo.
Come on, man. Really, come on, man. You and Billy Idol, man. Flesh for fantasy.
Fantasy. No, I mean, it's just not my thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But the reason why I thought it would be interesting to discuss with us having, you know, having our knowledge and our connection to the material be so lopsided is the fact that it has been like a cultural meteorite
phenomenon, sir,
that has it has just the ripples out, and its impact is just completely undeniable. I had a phone conversation with D, and I was telling him that it's the only thing you can really compare it to ultimately is Star Wars.
To
a lesser degree, like Harry Potter, and to an even lesser degree, maybe even The Walking Dead, in the sense that, I mean, it has transcended generations. Old people, young people, middle-aged people love the show. People of all races, socioeconomic backgrounds. It doesn't matter. And people have became completely invested in those characters and what they were doing. And me, Adrian, I can't speak for you. Me, I've never watched an entire episode, and yet I know characters' names.
Mm-hmm.
I know titles of I know titles of like, you know, like the big episodes, the Red Wedding,
right.
Mm-hmm.
and there's some episode about the bastards.
Mm-hmm. Damn,
yeah,
the something bastard, yeah, or something. Yeah. What is it, D?
I'm looking it up.
so well, don't look it up. Don't look
like
up.
The Battle of the Bastards, something along those lines, Joe.
Yeah, it was something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I know some of the actresses, mm-hmm, and the actors' names. Mm-hmm. I know situations. I know I know that Peter Dinklage is related to Ned, right?
Right. No.
Yeah.
No,
who's his brother?
His brother is the Dragon Killer, Jamie Lannister.
Jamie Lannister. Yeah. Right. I mean, I know so much about this show. I've seen the memes. I enjoy the memes.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoy the GIFs.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoy the hell out of the fan art.
Right.
The fan fiction, all of it, and yet I've not watched the show. And the thing that got me was the most of it I've ever watched is about the last 20 minutes of, what is the Long Night or the Miserable Night or whatever
the
it is.
The Long Night, yeah. The Miserable Night.
Yeah. I watched about the last 20 minutes of that, and I was into it. I was like, damn.
It's addictive.
I mean, I felt the stakes, and I felt, you know, the intensity of it, having never watched anything. And they, and D, you correct me if I'm wrong, that battle was sold, that clash with the Night King was sold all the way back to the first season, and I think the first episode. Weren't they talking about the Night King like all the way back at the beginning?
Well, no, he appears in the very first episode. Yeah, but as kind of like a cliff note, as a cliffhanger. But yeah, what's been happening the entire time for the Game of Thrones aficionados and those that aren't so much, and those that fall between like myself, is the winter's been coming. Winter's been coming since the first season, from the first episode. And the Night's Watch is basically the guardians of Westeros, which is a planet they're on, which is like old English, old England. They've been predicting this. It's been foretold for years and for generations this is coming. And now it's coming down to the line where this is actually a thing which is coming very, very soon. And nobody knows the signs. But there are characters which develop in this 10-season arc, which become very much a part of the change that is winter coming and what happens after that. So this whole thing is about the Stark family, about their comeuppance, well, their survival inside of Westeros, and how they're probably one of the least deceptive families in all the entire Westeros.
The Seven Kingdoms.
And the Seven Kingdoms. Yeah, they're like.
See, I know what the Seven Kingdoms
exactly,
are, yo.
Exactly. See.
I ain't had to watch a damn thing.
It's true.
It's just amazing to me that something like this, because you know D and I, again, we talked about this. You couldn't have predicted something like this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you couldn't have planned it. Nobody would have planned it. And the thing, and you know, it's like I mean, this is a show that's just bursting at the seams with rape, incest, murder, genocide, child torture,
mutilation.
You know, mutilation. I mean, it's just all of this stuff. And I'm like, how has this become? And I guess it's just the way that it's been woven between the original source material from George R. R. Martin to, you know, to Benioff and Weiss, and how they have adapted, you know, his stories and his tales and his characters.
Right.
And just made them sing in a very different way for this medium.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to ask you, D, I want to start by asking you, D, and I'm not trying to, I want Adrian to chime in too,
mm-hmm.
but I want, D, I want you to talk just for a minute about the fact that I'm sure they have altered and changed things from the books. And I don't know if you read the book. Did you read the book,
sir? I have not read the book, sir.
Okay, didn't read the
because
books.
The books are tomes. They're humongous. They're like James Clavell, like James Clavell's Shogun size books. So in between creating my own stuff and a casual read of comics, I don't have time to read that much source material. You know.
Okay, well, my question was just going to be, or the request was just going to be for you to talk about how, you know, they probably have changed things to adapt it for TV. But Adrian, what is your relationship? No matter how, you know, transient or how, what is your relationship to this show in terms of your being, you know, a person who's a fan of pop culture and TV and a nerd, you know, yourself, but you don't really like it. You don't fuck with it either.
Bro, I have never, ever, ever seen an episode, not 1 minute, not 1 second of that show, you know, and it's not necessarily because I dislike that genre, you know, but I'm kind of like yourself. I don't really get down with fantasy a lot, at least in that type of sense. But other than that, it's just, yeah, like I see the memes and I see everything and I kind of halfway know some of the characters.
Mm-hmm.
But where I come in is more or less just the phenomenon of it. You know what I'm saying?
Okay.
Just really being apart from it and seeing like, wow, people have glommed on to this thing like it's nothing else. Like, just, man, you know, it seemed like everyone watches it. Everyone.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, the reason that is because it's not about fantasy. See, therein lies the truth of it. See, it's about human beings doing human things and human circumstances for human reasons. So what it boils down to is you have a whole Anglican setup where there's feuding houses and deceptive monarchs and intermarrying of kings and queens for position, and you have races which are dominant and suppressed. You have races which are trying to survive and are taking off their land because of mistakes that their forefathers made. You have children which are trying to survive in this hostile environment that are finding their parents being taken away from them in various different directions. You have siblings which are being forced to go out on their own and do things. So it's very human. So the fantasy is just the icing on the cake. In fact, to that point, I don't recall any fantastical scenes except for the Night King's eyes glowing blue for about the first four episodes.
Well, everything no, else, I mean, well, I mean, well, come them? On, do you got dragons?
That's what I was going to say.
You got Arya stabbing him with a knife, and he just breaks into 1,000 pieces like the damn T-1000.
Now listen. You see? Okay. All
right. Dang.
Okay.
Go ahead, but see,
here's the thing. That's the pop culture side of things. That's what it's being sold as to people that are not really watching the entire show. They don't show dragons for almost two seasons. Dragons will come into like season three.
Okay, but they're there, right?
Right, they're there now, but they weren't there in the beginning.
Okay, what about in the long miserable night when they were fighting what essentially a bunch of zombies, yo? Come on. Right. That's but fantasy.
Right, it is. But my point is that the story itself is attachment to people in pop culture. They're fighting it not because of the fantastical side of things.
Right.
They're fighting it because of the human qualities that are invested in these characters and these people.
I don't mean to interrupt you. You're exactly right. It's just like The Walking Dead. When I tell people it's not really about zombies, it's about survival.
Right.
It's a survivalist story. They could be in the Old West fighting the Black Plague, or it could be airborne HIV. It doesn't matter what it is. It's the fact that they're having to scratching and surviving. You know, like Jefferson's theme.
Exactly. Yeah, the white wall is Cabrini Green, sir.
Dang,
it got tore down like it too.
South Side.
That's it.
Well, I mean, like, you know, even the cosplay, just all of it. I have really enjoyed all of it. Even like the whole final season where the fans really like took complete and utterly ridiculous ownership over this show to the point where they were like, okay, this is some bullshit. We're going to create a petition. We want you all to remake the whole last season and make it good. And here's how you should make it good. And I'm just like, wow. Even though that has happened before, there was actually a hard copy petition circulated back in the 80s. When they cast Michael Keaton as Batman. I don't know if you guys ever saw it.
I saw your post.
Yes. I did see it. Yeah.
But
And I recall that being a thing, like a serious thing. And I almost, like, to the point, like, I was almost in agreement with him, you know, because I looked at, okay, everything Michael Keaton had done to that point, not realizing that, you know, comedy, the other side of comedy is horror, you know. But, you know, I think that, you know, my I didn't see him as being a real effective person as far as that role goes in the beginning before I even saw in the movie. My supposition was, oh, he's got to be bad because all he does is do comedy and funny shit. And I was wrong. He carried it better through than most of the other Batmans after him, I think, up to that point in the 90s.
Go ahead, eh?
Well, I was going to interject on that point, Swizz, in terms of talking about the phenomena of, I don't know, for lack of a better term, just kind of like, you know, the social aspect of this show. You know, Now, I did see the headlines and everything about, you know, fans being in the uproar and a tiff and a tizzy about this final season and the petitions and all of that. Mm-hmm. And part of me, again, being on the outside looking in, I'm like, as popular as the show is and the following it has and everything, it's not a democracy. Mm-hmm. If you don't like this show, then you... if you don't like how the show went, tough tits. Sorry.
Turn off.
Sorry.
Yeah.
That's what they wrote. Exactly. You know what I'm saying? And all of this recent phenomena of, well, I don't like how that went down. Y'all need to do over. Right. Y'all need to redo that.
Right.
Nah.
Well, I think that, and ultimately, I think the schism comes from the fans of the original source material, George R.R. Martin's, and what was inside Game of Thrones in the HBO series of Benioff and Weiss was that they had gotten it right for so long, it was hand in hand what George R.R. Martin was trying to create inside the books, and they realized when it came down to the final season that all they had was basically a template,
a treatment,
a treatment for what George R.R. Martin had to say. They really took homage to that because they felt as though it was rushed and it was incomplete, especially when they found out that, oh no, these guys are going to do Star Wars, so they're putting the kibosh on this because
they're like, man, we got to get up out of here, man, right?
Because
we about to leave Westeros and head up to Tatooine and Mos Eisley.
exactly. So yeah, so they felt as though they were rushed. And completing it because HBO, they said we can go on for another 4 or 5 seasons, you know.
Of course they did because they're whores and they want the money.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And indeed, that brings up the other point I was going to say in regards to that. Did Martin finish the book?
No, still not finished.
He still hadn't finished it.
Okay. And that's my crux right there. It's like you're trying to build a transcontinental railroad across the country, but you have no end in sight.
Right.
It's like you're building a track, but you're still trying to learn how to use a train at the same time, and you're inching up the track.
Let's open some track up there.
Exactly. So when it does, figuratively go off the rails or whatnot, right, you shouldn't be surprised because there's no track there. Mm-hmm. And I also have an issue with the source material not being finished. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, in this case, when Martin is writing or whenever he does finish it,
right,
who's to say he's going to diverge from his original vision he had in just his head?
And he won't. Well,
versus like, oh, I got to make this consistent with what's being written in this adaptation of what I've done.
No, what he said. I'm sorry, let me interrupt you. What he said on CBS in 60 Minutes was that, and it like a lot of other great writers, a lot of writers we're fans of and comics and things. He's like, well, what I write inside the book is the book. It will always be the book. The movie, the television show doesn't change that. So when he writes the ending of the book, that's what the ending's going to be for the book. And it doesn't have to necessarily coincide with what happened inside the movies at all, television show at all. And that's his right as the author of that.
I didn't mean to interrupt you. You're exactly right, D. That is his right to do it the way he wants. And Adrian, I mean, it's not new that they would want to adapt something into another medium before the source material was finished. That happens all the time with these comic properties that get optioned and get licensed or get picked up to be made into television shows and movies. Sometimes I'm sure everything Mark Miller does is optioned probably before he's even finished it and submitted it to the publisher. Mm-hmm. I mean, everything. I mean, he's just that, you know, that
he got the golden touch.
He's just that bankable as a comic creator and as a creator of this kind of material. But the thing about it is, to me, is the fact that, okay, if... like, it's a dangerous thing for me because if Martin hasn't finished his writing and he's seen what Benioff and Weiss have done with the 8th season, even if he doesn't do what they did, the fact that he may not like what they did, the fact that he may disagree with some of the character interpretations, the fact that he may look at the fan backlash, it can still affect the decisions that he makes now after the fact as a writer. In other words, subconsciously, it could change the course of what he's going to do. He can't not be affected by that. It would have just been better to just have him finish it and say it's done. And then you can always make that claim that writers and creators always make is that, well, you still have the original comics. So, you know, to hell with the movie or to hell with the TV show or to hell with whatever this other thing is that people think doesn't live up to it. You know what I mean?
Right, sure. And I agree 100% with that. My thing is, though, is Lacey's astute enough to make the claim that that's what his overall onus is as far as what he's responsible for his side of the game. His side of the game is the Game of Thrones is a series of books. The Song of Ice and Fire is one chapter of that, which is what this entire series has been based on, the Songs of Ice and Fire. Right. And there's more to it than that. So if he wants to continue the story, continue the saga, because it is his stuff, he can do what he wants to do with it as long as he stays alive. So yeah. whether that veers from the TV show or whatever, that doesn't matter. I mean, the TV show was a phenomenon unto itself. The books, arguably, I mean, were phenomenal, but because Benioff and Weiss put the fire underneath it and had a stellar cast. Another thing too, let's talk about casting, man.
Yeah.
I mean, my God. I mean, they invented some people's careers on this show. I mean, Macy Williams was not a name, you know. Kit Harington was not a name, you know. My girl Clark, she was not a name, you know. And now she is, to the point to where in the middle of recording some of those things, in the middle of being Khaleesi, being Daenerys Targaryen,
Jon Snow, etc.
Yeah, they went off and became head of the career, had more work because of the success of Game of Thrones. So success, and I think. Pop culture phenomenon can be a great thrust for the careers of nascent and small actors. You know, I mean, you know, oh boy, Peter Dinklage has already said that, you know, Game of Thrones will always have a soft spot in his heart that he'll never be able. It's probably the greatest role of his career. You know,
well, you know, that's the thing is, like, of everyone there, I think maybe Dinklage was doing stuff. And probably had, you know, a career as a character actor before he was on the show. Because mm-hmm. I had heard of Peter Dinklage before Game of Thrones, if I'm not mistaken. I think I had.
Yeah, yeah.
But
he was in a... Good.
Well, go ahead. What were you going to say?
He was in that movie with Will Ferrell. The giant elf that Will Ferrell played.
Oh, Elf.
Wait, Elf?
Yeah, Elf. Okay, Elf. He was in that, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
But I think I had heard of Lena Headey prior to that.
Yeah. She was in.
You have. Yeah.
She's awesome.
She was in 300.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. She was in 300. Yeah. Adrian scrunching up fur in his brow.
Yeah. And she's in the short-lived John Connor Chronicles for sci-fi.
Sarah Connor Chronicles.
Was it Sarah Connor?
Sarah Connor Chronicles.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, there
short
we
lived.
Go.
Short-lived. There you go.
Well, what about, is it Natalie Dormer? Is she the one who plays the slave on the show?
Yeah, Melisandre. But see, he just crunches his nose up. But actually,
let's get it out here, Nadi. Let's go ahead and get it out here, Nadi.
Hold on, Sean.
Hold on now. This is another thing about the cultural impact and the fully embracing of this show by all kinds of peoples that mystifies me. Okay.
Okay.
Now I watch a lot of stuff. I watch a lot of movies. I watch a lot of television. I've watched a lot of television and movies in my lifetime. And I've read a lot of comics, and most of what I've consumed has been white characters as the leads and as the co-leads. So
sure.
I'm amazed at a show that, for lack of a better term, is the white people show on HBO. I mean, the two main black characters, Grey Worm and Natalie Dormer's character, aren't they slaves? Or didn't they start out as slaves?
They start out as actually, it's a little deeper than that, Adrian. It's not the kind of fix it up.
I'll clean that shit up.
We're talking fantasy slaves. We're not talking about. Let me clarify.
Dig yourself deeper, y'all.
Didn't they say that on Fox News? These are fantasy slaves. They're not real slaves.
No, no. Let me.
We're gonna pay fantasy reparations.
Let me clarify.
Go ahead, man.
Let me clarify. Let me clarify. So, when you're looking at, when I say fantasy, it's they're more focused on not racial slavery, but on taking poor peoples and making them slaves. So, Grey Worm is from a caste society that was born to be a warriors. Natalie's people were born to be slave, not slave hands per se, but servitude. So in a classic word, in classic servitude, not the kind of slavery which African peoples of face. This is a different kind of slavery. This is more like indentured servitude than slavery. So they weren't getting beaten on a regular basis by their slave masters. They weren't getting parts cut off.
Oh my God.
They weren't getting parts of the body.
Oh my God. This is not getting any better, yo.
You know, I'm just saying they just weren't. I'm just saying, you know, you brought it up as being a point of interest, and that's not what it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, but so here's the thing. The main two black characters on the show have they have the humblest position on the show. One of the humblest positions of the above line cast.
Arguably. I think
they have to be a couple. Like, you didn't see Jason Momoa trying to get down with Natalie Dormer. You didn't see Ned Stark trying to get down with Natalie Dormer. It's got to be let the two brown people get down together. Because
actually, that's not how it went. Because what
happened
was, don't
get me wrong, Natalie Dormer is fine, yo.
I've seen
pictures of her.
She is fine.
Natalie Emmanuel.
So. She could get it, but go ahead.
Natalie Emmanuel.
Okay, I'm wrong. See,
but here's the thing. See, first off, Jason Momoa's character belonged to the horse clans, and he did get down repeatedly with Khaleesi, the blonde haired white chick, in the show. Okay,
to the point where they've actually had
a baby, and that child actually led to the conception of the dragon children, which were Khaleesi's dragon children. So she didn't have a natural born baby. she had the dragon children instead. Yeah.
I'm just saying, like, savage dragon or something.
No. Had bestiality
So. I'm sorry.
Eric Larson coming for them checks, yo.
Right.
So. Go ahead, D.
Go ahead. We sorry, so, man. I'm sorry.
Make
man.
It you plain, know, sir.
the point is that, Khaleesi herself, basically, here's the thing. Mia Kark's character, Daenerys Targaryen, is a child that had to leave her family behind or left. She left her community because she was chased out because her family was all but destroyed. She's one of the last of the two Targaryens, to the best of their known origin.
Isn't Jon Snow a Targaryen?
Well, that comes along down the line. Okay.
Yeah.
But right now it's basically her and her brother. Her brother was a bastard. Her brother's the one that sold her to the slave clans with the idea of being able to get her to barter so they can get an army big enough to be able to go back and take on the Lannisters. The Lannisters are the dominant clan with nobody crosses them. Their army is superior to most other armies out there, arguably, and to cross them is death. Jaime Lannister, one of the Lannister brothers who actually screws his sister and has a couple bastard children by her, is one, namely Joffrey, lost track. Anyway, back to as far as the slave clans. Okay, so you had.
Okay, well, not explaining it all. I mean, you can't go give us every detail on it. Just sum it up, yo. Sum it up as best you can.
In summary, they're not slaves because of their race. They're slaves because of their culture and servitude. But when Khaleesi comes along, you know, she says, okay,
of course,
I have this vision of a bigger world, and I'd like for you guys to join me in this. Not as slaves, but as partners. So by the time everything is done and through with the Game of Thrones, not only is the soldier who was quote unquote her right hand man emancipated or freed because of her death, but because she made him captain of the guard or whatever, of her guard over all the entire Westeros, he actually strikes off on his own with his people to find another land. So that's not the story of a slave. That's the story of a man who was in a certain situation, who overcame that situation, and then grew into his own.
Okay, so here's the thing. Now, that's the other thing. Didn't Natalie Emanuel's character get killed?
She did get killed.
Yeah, okay. So yeah. One half of the two main brown characters on the show got killed. Okay, that's fine. But to take everything that you said, Dean, I get all of that.
Yeah.
But I'm still saying it's as a cultural thing, if you pull mm-hmm. back from it, the creators of the show, the writers of the show, the producers of the show, the executive producers, everybody said, hey, we're going to cast this thing, and out of 24 main above line characters, I think that's the term they use in film and television, out of all these characters, 24 people, we're going to cast 2 brown people, and they just happen to be, again, in this precarious situation. They're not the grand ones on the balcony, like Cersei, drinking wine and laughing at motherfuckers getting slaughtered. They're not going into battle. They did in the 8th season. They're not going into battle as the leader of the army and the, you know, seen as the, you know, the once in future king or the prince to one day take the throne. They are the lowers in the society.
No, because Grey Worm has always been seen as an equal, man. Grey Worm has always been like leader of Khaleesi's armies.
Okay.
He's always gone into battle. He's in fact.
You're saying from the first season he has.
Yeah. He's okay. Always been a leader. But yeah, the Horse Clans. He's always gone in and not the Horse Clans. He's always gone in and served, you know, served Khaleesi well because he believes in the vision. He's seen slavery up by the masters, you know, and he doesn't agree with the slavery by the masters. And his girl, who speaks several languages, you know, Natalie Emanuel's character, has been, you know, oppressed and things like that. And many people have been oppressed by those guys. So he sees an opportunity to make the world right, you know. He doesn't see her as an oppressive character. So,
okay.
And she never has one conversation during the entire time. Like, if you don't do this, I'm going to do this. You know, so she never threatens him one time. She's threatened other characters. She threatened Peter Dinklage's character several times. You know, you have one more time to betray me and it's over. You know, she's threatened, you know, here's the beauty of Game of Thrones, man. At any point in time, any character can die in Game of Thrones. That became a cultural phenomenon first. When they took Ned Stark's head, who was the first guy you saw sitting in the Game of Thrones poster.
Sean Bean's character,
Sean Bean.
Damn, he dies every movie. Yeah,
that's that's a meme, too. That's a meme, too. You know, that's a meme, too. Boromir, you know, he's Boromir in Lord of the Rings, and he Fellowship Ring, he died. So
first to die.
You know?
Yeah.
So he dies in everything, you know. And I guess that should have been a clue for some people that he was possibly disposable. But the fact this character was tiltulary to the entire storyline, you thought, okay, he would last longer than that. So people were in an uproar about that. And then you knew, all the actors knew at that point, it was on. Anybody at that point in time can die. So they felt
Well, yes, but even I, again, as someone who didn't watch the show, you knew that Khaleesi's character wasn't going to die anytime soon. You knew Jon Snow's character wasn't going to die anytime soon.
Well, he did die, but he came back.
Right, okay, see? You knew that Cersei was not going to die anytime soon, and some of the and then everybody else. Yeah, it could probably happen. As a matter of fact, I was listening to a podcast, Small Doses, geez, why can't I remember her name?
Because it was Small Dose.
I was listening to Small Doses, and Amanda Seals who's a big fan of the show. She was saying, like, you know, the deaths that occurred during the long night or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
She said none of them were really surprising. Like, none of them really, in her opinion, she said none of those were really surprised.
I disagree.
You thought some of them were?
Yeah, I did.
Which ones?
I thought the one that died next to Khaleesi was a surprise to me. Because
Bruce Wayne?
No, not Bruce Wayne.
Yeah. No, Bruce Wayne.
That's Bruce Wayne?
He's cast as Bruce Wayne in the New Titans season two.
Oh, I was like,
yeah, okay. Yeah. So well, I knew he was gonna go.
Based on that, right?
So he got something else to do.
Yeah, I got another job, yo. I booked another gig.
Right. Right. Yeah, exactly. But I didn't think he was gonna go out like that. I mean, I like the fact that he went down because he was probably the one person I think that really loved Daenerys the most. I mean, he was twice her age, you know, but he loved her. Like he went through hell and high water for her. Like okay. I thought, oh, damn, you know, if he goes, you know, what the hell's going to, you know, what else is going to happen? I knew Jon Snow was going to die because to me, it was to the very end, it was going to be like Jon Snow and Daenerys ruling. That's what it should have been.
It should have been
Jon Snow and Daenerys ruling, but that wasn't how the writers saw fit to make it happen.
Well,
you know?
Let me ask you this, D, because, and this is, I kind of want to get to too, and I want Adrian to chime in on this as well, that, you know, a lot of the fan criticism about season 8. While, you know, certainly, you know, they were rabid and had the taste of blood in their mouths when things weren't going their way.
And other things.
But a large part of the criticism that I heard that I thought was completely valid and fair was to say that I, as a fan of this show and as a consumer of this material and as an audience member, was not satisfied with the way some of these things happened. And not like, oh, everybody all up in arms because in The Last Jedi, Luke went out this way and he should have gone out. You know, there are people who will disavow The Last Jedi simply because Luke didn't go out in a blaze of glory. But in this particular... Okay. But my thing is this. For people to say this was unsatisfying... Cersei dying under rubble in the bottom of the castle in the basement, that was unsatisfying. You know, for Khaleesi to turn as quickly as she did, and then like the next episode she dies, that was unsatisfying. You know what I'm saying? It was multiple things,
right,
that they pointed to, and I think it's completely valid for an audience member to say this wasn't satisfying to me. This didn't, you didn't like, you sold me one thing in door number one, and then by the time we got to door number three, it was something else. You know what I mean? I don't think that's unfair. Now the whole redo the season and, you know, whatever. And to Dee's point, the reason they feel that way is because D&D, Benioff and Weiss got it right for so many seasons prior to that. And, right. and they did such an excellent job and it made the show, endeared the show to so many people over the time, you know, over the 8-9 years or whatever it was.
Right, 8 years roughly.
They were just appalled that, okay, this is where we are. But I think it was a complete valid criticism. What do you guys think?
I mean, from a person that's watched the show, I think it was valid, but I think it was also aggressively self... Like I think the way that fans have taken it upon themselves to try and rewrite something that was written by somebody else is
of course, yeah, that's way over the line, yeah.
Right. I mean, that's just a disservice to who they are as people, for one thing, and also, I mean, let it be what it's going to be. You know, if you can predict everything inside a movie, that makes it very, very boring. I think that the fact that kicked everybody knocked off their feet. You know, and some of the choices they made were aggressive, not the way we would have ended it. It ended the way that kept us interested and engaged the entire time. And that's to their credit. So Jon Snow kills Khaleesi. He's probably the only one that could have done it.
He is the only one that could have done it to get that close. That would have been the only thing that would have been satisfying in terms of Khaleesi dying. And you knew Khaleesi was going to have to die after she torched the whole village.
Right, but she just did it with purpose. But I'll get into that a little bit later. But Arya would have been the person for me that might have snuck into her. Arya was like a ninja. She was like the man of all faces. She could get into places that and be Jon Snow, acting like she was Jon Snow, and get closer to her and kill her. She could do that. That's her ability.
But Arya, from what I understand, her goal was not to kill Khaleesi. Her goal was to kill Cersei.
Right.
Matter of fact, she was trying to get into the castle to kill Cersei when Man Mountain Marco showed up, yo. But Adrian, do you know what I'm talking about? Like, you know, there are times where, of course, you know, you're going to feel like some things get missed or something gets missed. But for me, it's just like, okay, sometimes you things are like a total miss where you're like, okay, this seemed weird. And, you know, and even people saying it felt like it was rushed, you know, like I think Mark Bernardin's assessment, D, and I know you heard it on Fat Man on Batman. I think his assessment was great that there are certain singers in popular music over the last 50 to 60 years, Frank Sinatra and people like that, Whitney Houston, who didn't write songs, but they could take songs and interpret them magnificently. That was their gift. You give me the thing, the content, and I will make it come alive. And maybe that was Benioff and Weiss's gift, was to take these roadmaps and cull them down and put their spin on them and really make them, you know, sing for the medium of television. And when they didn't have a roadmap, when they only had like a napkin where somebody said, you know, get on 285 and get off at 85 South and then go down to Claremont Road and make a right, and then you're going to run into Book Nook. You know what I'm saying?
Right. That's exactly true, actually, but go ahead.
You know what I mean? That's all they had, and it was like, okay, and they got lost along the way, and there were digressions, and there were rabbit trails, but do you see what I'm getting at, Adrian?
Yeah.
I do. And, you know, I was thinking of, you know, another HBO series that I could try to make an analogy to, and that would be The Wire. And in particular, that fifth season. Now, that fifth season has some strong points to it, definitely. But there are a couple points where it felt like it did jump the shark, you know, like in terms of like, and these characters wouldn't necessarily do that. These characters wouldn't, you know, act this way. This is so out of what has been established already, you know. And as a fan of that series up to that point, obviously, it's like, there were points where I was kind of unsatisfied with it, but I didn't feel so strongly that I was like, oh, I need to redo it. You know,
right?
You know, at some point, you just have to say, look, trust the storytellers. You know, if the story doesn't end the way that you think it should end, unfortunately, that's the way it is. You know what I'm saying? Often, like people in real life, characters meet ignoble ends.
They do.
You know, it's not always going to be that's part of the irony, you know, of storytelling, too. You know, you have these very grandiose situations, these very, you know, magnificent characters who meet these very low ends. You know, so it's almost like a counterpoint to, you know, the height that that character reached, only to be brought down low to this, you know. So in some cases that could work, but I think what fans are looking for is just for everything to end on a high.
Right.
Everything to be, you know, just magnificent.
Right.
And you can't do that always in storytelling.
Yeah.
You have to have those peaks and valleys.
Right. To encapsulate what you're saying in a time capsule that perhaps my generation can relate to. What happened in season 8 basically was Empire for Star Wars, wherein it ended on a low point for our heroes, and you didn't know what was going to happen after that. You know, I think even though, you know, they managed to swing it off in the last episode to where a character that had been kind of important the entire time, but maybe not as important as people wanted him to be. But actually, we watched this story, watched him develop the entire time to the person he actually became in the story, and that was to become a king at the end of it.
Bran.
We watched how this little boy climbed the side of a building innocently, as little boys do, and get pushed by two incestuous brothers and sisters to his death. He survived that death, you know, and was paralyzed after that. And his entire time, he was paralyzed the entire time throughout the show. Now, what happens to him during the course of the show? Yeah, of course, what happens in the course of the show? He's chosen by the powers that be of Westeros, the spiritual powers that be of Westeros, to become what's called the Three-Eyed Raven, right? Which is basically like this insightful mystical character, kind of a Doctor Strange, if you will, or even a Professor X, if you will. But he can see into the past, present, and future of Westeros, right?
Adrian. They got memes of him with his eyes turning white, like he's doing his mental thing. Talking about he over there getting Wi-Fi.
Dang, yo. So, just a very small digression, D. Mm-hmm. If he was paralyzed the wet night, mm-hmm. like, is he like paraplegic and they just kind of sit him?
He's in a chair. He only does nothing but sit in a chair the whole time.
All he can do is move his arms. No, he does more than that. You know, he talks and stuff. He's very.
Oh, I mean, he's
like Stephen Hawking or something.
He's
articulate. Right. He can't move around.
So he's like Stephen Hawking.
Yeah, kind of like Stephen Hawking. A little bit like that. Kind of like that. Yeah.
Winter is coming.
You're wrong, yo.
That's terrible. That's terrible. Edit that out of the show.
Man, right. Damn, yo. Rest in peace. Rest in peace.
R.I.P. to the science god, yo. Right. Shout out to the great brain, yo.
Yeah, man.
You know what? But the I think, and to make another slight digression, I think even a comparison to be made to The Last Jedi, for me, mm-hmm. as a Star Wars fan and as someone who has pretty much liked the way that they have reignited the series, you know, with The Force Awakens, with The Last Jedi, for me, I was fine with the way that Luke went out. I think they could have sliced out the whole storyline with Laura Dern's character.
Mm.
And it had Leia be the one to sacrifice mm-hmm. herself in the ship, and yeah. that would have felt somewhat poetically satisfying for her to meet her demise that way. As far as Luke, I like the fact that Luke was older and smarter, and not necessarily like, I'm not finna be swashbuckling with these little young bucks out here, you know, slinging damn lightsabers and throwing spells. He was smart instead of using his athleticism. And I mean, he's a 60-something-year-old man. He should be. That's what he should be. He should outsmart the little young guy.
Mm,
yeah.
Right.
So anyway, but
I'll say this. I mean, for Luke, and this is based on my love for the overall genre and love for the Star Wars saga. Period.
Mm-hmm.
There are Jedi's that are twice his age from other races that have done more, as far as tutelage and as far as fighting ability that he did
in the movies.
Arguably, no.
Then that doesn't matter. That's a different universe, D.
Right, but I'm saying EU universe. But I'm saying, you know, that's the level of expectation that comes along with being in Star Wars. People have gone. Here's the thing about George Lucas. He did it. He laid out a great plan for execution for Star Wars, right? But he didn't do only so many of those movies inside of a 10 to 15, 20 year span, right? So he left a lot of area to be filled by other people the way they need to fill it to make sure that the story is being told to some sense of completion, right? So
I disagree. Disney,
well, you would because you're not a fan like I am. But when Disney took over it, what they should have done, it would have been a simple way of ingratiating yourself with the fans and building an alliance with the people that are going to support this IP by taking some of the EU, the existing universe, and adapting it to, which they're doing now anyway, which adapting it to screen format, because that way you can make sure that things which had gone before, even like since Lucas honestly wasn't a good storyteller, let's be honest, he wasn't a good storyteller. His strength wasn't in backstory. His strength was in visual execution. That's what Lucas's strength is.
Okay.
And I think that when you look at like the backstory that's been given by other people, take that and utilize that for your own benefit, because it's ultimately your stuff anyway, and put that into Lucasfilm and make it a part of Lucasfilm natural. And then you'll be able to have more fan service. Then fans will be more satisfied with it because they've seen what's happened before, and you know, it'll be a better situation.
I disagree only because and as it relates to Game of Thrones, because you know, as we all know, they're going to launch a follow-up series or whatever.
Well, it's a prequel. A thousand years before. Yeah,
a thousand years before prequel. So,
which I'm not interested.
Yeah, but the problem with that is this. You had like a decade of Star Wars, and even when you did the prequels in the 90s, everything is still, that's like two decades, right? Mm-hmm. Let's say. Mm-hmm. It's all based on Skywalkers and Darth Vader and Leia and whose mother. It's all based on that clan. Part of the problem that, that you're going to see with Star Wars movie, and I don't want this to turn into a Star Wars conversation, but with Star Wars moving forward to try to tell other stories is once you leave behind Luke Skywalker, Leia, Vader, the Imperial, you know, all of the Empire, all of that stuff, you leave all that stuff behind, now your older fans are going to be like, well, that's not my Star Wars, and there's a chance that the audience gets smaller. That's why they that's why they keep coming back to this, man. No, I know you'll like it. But I'm saying older audience is going to be like, that's not my Star Wars. Just like if they cast Michael B. Jordan as Batman Bruce Wayne, they're going to be like, that's not my Batman. Like if they make, you know, Thor a woman in the movies, they'd be like, well, that's not my Thor. Chris Hemsworth is my Thor. That's just how people are going to be. And then you take a chance on the IP in that medium getting smaller. And this may be what happens with Game of Thrones when they do this prequel. It'd be like people may not care. Like you said, this was a special cast, a special group of people. You couldn't have planned it. Some of the casting choices were probably last minute as hell. Like, they probably had other people cast as certain characters, and then their schedule didn't work out, and then somebody else filled in. Like, Hugh Jackman with Doug Ray Scott playing Wolverine. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, at the last minute, Doug Ray Scott couldn't do it, and Hugh Jackman, who had auditioned for it multiple times, just get sent in like 3 weeks before shooting. Boom, here you are. So I don't know, man. I wonder where this is going to go. And this actually leads me to the other question, or the final question is you know, again, we can kind of compare this somewhat tangentially to like The Sopranos or Harry Potter or The Walking Dead or I'm trying to think of some others, The Wire maybe, to a much, much lesser degree, because The Wire was never a hit. You know, The Wire was never a big success. But certainly Star Wars, and certainly, you know, to the kind of fandom that we see for something like Star Trek. But, I mean,
Lord of the Rings even. Even Lord of the Rings
Exactly. Even Lord of the Rings, would certainly fall in that as well. So I just wonder if we're going to see something like that again soon, and I wonder how much of the intensity of Game of Thrones was aided by the fact that people could watch the show, record it, make GIFs and memes, and put them online that night, the next day. People could not sit around at work and, you know, around the coffee machine and talk about the latest episode. You could text somebody immediately after the show went off. People would tweet and would post on social media as the show is going on. And I wonder how much all of that as a cultural phenomenon helped to make it the juggernaut that it is. And I just wonder if this is just a special time now and we may not see that again. I mean, what do you guys think?
I think that to your point, I think the cultural phenomenon comes from part and parcel the cast and characters and the deconstruction, if you will, of the idea and concept of what fantasy is. Most high fantasy has these great long-winded soliloquies about, I will do this, that, and the other, blah, 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 I'll take the sword, blah, 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 blah. It's like, I'll cut the fucker's head off, or that cunt, or that asshole, or, you know, get that piece of shit out of my face. It's like, yeah, I'll whoop your ass with it. And you know, the thing is, they were very crass. And I think we live in a crass society. And I think that ultimately it hit a note with the subjectiveness and the constant idea of who we are as a society right now. So I think it came along at a time when people, you know, are dealing with certain things, and it was a point of, like, there's a character named King Joffrey.
Mm-hmm.
And he was an abject asshole.
Wait a minute, isn't that Eddie Murphy's father in Coming to America, King Joffrey?
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Joffrey. He's not worthy of my son.
Right, exactly. This is Joffrey Baratheon Lannister, what do you want to call him? But he not King Joffrey Joffer, but... yeah, man, he was a bastard, man. And... he was an asshole, and the kind of degree of anger that was languished upon him as a character actually transferred to him as a person when he left the show, and he just decided he would quit Hollywood after that. Like, he literally left Hollywood. He does no Hollywood stuff. This is his one and only. This is like this is his final role. Now he's in England. He has his own because he's got that long money from Game of Thrones. he has his own company. He does his own acting company, and he does Shakespearean plays, whatever the kind of plays he wants to do. My point is that there won't be another Game of Thrones like this in our lifetime, because it's not one of those things you could plan for. It just happens. And I think people glommed onto it because it was modern. It wasn't old English speak. It was very, very crude and digestible based on modern sensibilities.
Hey, D, pause for 1 second. I'll make a comparison that you have made in the past, and maybe this is a good one to see or to make. It's like what you were saying about Star Wars, where all of the depictions of the future in science fiction prior to Star Wars was this pristine, sterile environment, 2001. You know, everything is super clean and super sleek and super modernized and super, right. You know, everything is electronic and whatnot. And the Star Wars future, there were elements of that there, but the Star Wars future was dirty and dilapidated. And yes, it was future tech, but it was future tech that was already 100 years old by the time this story was being told. And maybe that's kind of what you're talking about here with them doing this kind of what would typically be called, I guess, in TV and film is like castle intrigue. Mm-hmm. You know, who will take the throne? Who will be the leader? And who will be stabbed in the back? And, you know, and all of the dirty dealings behind the scenes. But it's always done with these grand British accents and in these grand statements like you're talking about. But it sounds like you're saying that, some of these motherfuckers were gutter.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. They're like, it's like, you see, get away from me, you old cunt. You know, it's just they went for it. They went into all kinds of places. I mean, the taking of and the raping of one of the main characters that lasted almost the very last episode by this horse clansman, that was a rough scene, man. You know, Khaleesi, Momoa's character and Khaleesi, that was rough. You know, there was no love in that.
Yeah.
You know? And you know, but yet it evolved and changed into something that was you know, compassionate and passionate, and she held him in a high esteem, you know. So, you know, things like that don't transcend to they transcend into pop culture ideals, but they don't really like make for a good classical fantasy. You know, it may have happened, but not in the same way and as graphic. And I think the sensibilities that it had were for a modern audience, which it found and made its way into memes and in the pop culture. And they started seeing these things like, did this really happen inside this? And then once they started seeing it for themselves, like, damn, this is happening on a regular basis. And then they're like, did they become fascinated by it? Like, wow, this has a story that's interesting to engaging too. But the sex shit's going on, and that's cool. And this death shit, it's brutal. And, you know, the way they talk to each other with no regard and disregard, you know, That's something that people can really grasp onto and engage, become engaged.
Medieval snapping on them in the medieval.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was straight gutter, man. It was straight gutter, man. And I think they really were successful with that, and that's part of the success, you know. I think too.
Yeah.
You know, transcending ages, man. Like modernizing Shakespeare, it's not something you could do and maintain a straight face, you know. And that's what these guys did, you know. Modernizing the Bible, for that matter, is something that you simply, it's hard to do. And that's what these guys did, you know? And that's part of the cultural impact we're finding. You know, everybody likes great stories, man. Whether it's fantasy, science fiction, you know, straight fiction, whatever you have it, you know?
Right.
And when you find characters that you become attracted to and hold dear and hold a special place to you, not because you care about them as far as characters goes, just because their dynamics are so interesting when they oppose other characters, that makes for interesting storytelling, and that's engaging, and that's what you found in the situation. Okay. As I step down on my soapbox.
That's all right.
Adrian?
I don't know. To me, it's and again, obviously having never seen the episodes, but you know, looking at the effect, you know, of this phenomenon on just in general, you know, just following social media and so forth, you know, it's funny how people are squeamish about, you know, this stuff happening, you know, in actuality or whatnot, but, you know, have no problem seeing it on the show. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, you're talking about the rapes and all this stuff, you know, this really, you know, crazy stuff going on there. And, you know, people talked about it with, I don't want to say with glee, but just like, wow, I can't believe this happened. And they're like nonplussed by it, you know?
Yeah.
I guess obviously because it's fiction or whatnot, but those are the same people that will turn around and be like, oh man, this is happening for real in the society and everything. So like, that's one aspect that, you know, I don't know if it will be reconciled, but you know, the other thing too is just how it just took over like modern life, like seriously, like you could not turn around while Game of Thrones was going on. You cannot turn around and not hear about it. Like, you know, by osmosis, I knew some of the characters. I don't know the storylines. I don't know episode names or anything like that, but I know character names and I know, you know, certain things about
events.
It.
Yeah.
Exactly. When it really hit me was when we went to Spectrum Fantastic Art Live several years ago. And you could not turn around there. I think that was like the second. Yeah, it was the second Spectrum. And there was fan art galore. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
By these incredible artists. And they were doing their versions of these characters. You know, obviously, John Picaccio. JP. Exactly.
What's up,
you know, and his versions were coming out just as the series was starting to gain steam.
Right.
You know, so it was very interesting to see, like, he was basing his
on
off of the actual book itself, the source material.
Yeah.
And then it's side by side with the actual series itself. So that kind of fascinated me, you know, to see that he was, even though he's obviously a fan of the show itself, he was still basing his depictions on the source material. And it was just really cool to see that. And not only just him, but others, you know, do their interpretations as well. And when we went to Spectrum, that's when it kind of started to hit me like, this is a thing.
Right.
Like, this might be going somewhere.
Yeah.
Right.
Like, wow.
Yeah. Right.
People are into this.
Yeah. Right.
You know what I'm saying? And then it just snowballed from there to the point where it's like a part of your life.
No pun
intended.
Like,
you know, you go to Starbucks. Yeah. You go to Starbucks and
John Snowball.
Somebody talking about Game of Thrones.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, man.
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
You know, I'm grateful for times like these, man. I'm grateful for times where that fiction with promise becomes a dominant focus of pop culture, you know, especially when it comes to fiction, which has always been kind of on the outskirts of appreciation, you know, amongst pop culture. So I enjoy all the. I mean, when I come to work and two of my associates are talking about, you know, Game of Thrones, that's when I knew it transcended, you know, beyond. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Beyond what I was expecting. It's like, you know, wait, you're watching Game of Thrones? Like, yeah, it's awesome. Have you seen the new Dragon? It's like, wow. yeah. Where were you when I was, you know, several years ago when this first started? You know, I just started watching it, but I'm catching up to it. And before I know it, you know, this person in particular had surpassed. I mean, they had really dug into the idea of binge watching and watched damn near 6 seasons in a matter of 3 weeks.
Wow.
Damn.
And that's Jesus. And that is a commitment. I mean, that is a serious commitment.
Yeah.
To the point we're having conversations about it now or had conversations about it. And it's fascinating, man. It's fascinating. You know, and the fact that the characters can be so well written, the source material is so well written that these characters can compel people to want to know more about them, you know? I mean, that's the real testament to me, man, is to write a character which brings people in that aren't used to the source material that can relate to it is incredible, you know.
Yeah.
And that's my overall assessment.